From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. John McKay here, in for Chris Boyd. Larry McMurtry, James Michener, Cormac McCarthy, Texas authors you've heard of. What about Fort Worth-born Patricia Highsmith? Well, try this, Strangers on a Train, The Talented Mr. Ripley, The Price of Salt. Those are just a few of her works. She died living in Switzerland in 1995, and now the publishing of her extensive diaries has revealed a woman more at home with animals than people, who had a little love for Jews or sometimes minorities, and yet someone whose monumental body of work, even in this age of cancel culture, continues to be embraced by the public. Patricia Highsmith's longtime editor, Anna von Planta, is here. She edited the newly released Patricia Highsmith, her diaries and notebooks. Anna, welcome to Think.
Hello, wonderful to be here.
You went through 8,000 pages of Patricia Highsmith's notebooks and her diary and entries, to complete this project. That in and of itself is just a monumental project.
Yes, it is. It is daunting. Luckily, there were sort of early chores that sort of kept the dauntingness at bay. One had to, all these 8,000 pages had to be transcribed. Highsmith's handwriting is very difficult to read, despite the fact that it looks kind of even and lovely. Then they had to be annotated. Then many of her early diaries are written in her French, her German, her Italian, and her Spanish, and had to be then translated into English. All these were preliminary chores, and only then did I start to actually work with the material.
Yeah, she is. She is self-taught in five languages, and constantly trying to improve herself. Was it to try to improve herself, or was it more along the lines of she may have been concerned about others looking at her diaries and notebooks?
Well, probably both, and maybe a third thing as well. I would say that her biological father was of German descent, so that was kind of a mythical background, and she loved Goethe and Schiller and Rilke and Freud, and read them widely. But it was French. Then she had many girlfriends or just friends in New York in the 40s and 50s, particularly in the 40s, who were refugees from Europe and were very polished and independent women. So she admired them immensely. Then she also wanted to be a woman of the world. Europe, up to a certain extent, was like uptown on a continental scale, if you like. Then, of course, she wanted to keep her diaries protected, and she knew that the people who she lived with had not such a command of foreign languages, so that was a kind of making them cryptic. But it was a little bit of all of this, and maybe also a way of going beyond English, going beyond the means and vocabulary into a kind of semi-conscious language that she knew she didn't really command, but could use. Maybe kind of, she writes French and German as though she were writing English, just using the French words or the German words. So it's kind of looking at English from a distance.
You know, the title says diaries, plural, that Patricia Highsmith kept. There was more than one diary?
There were 18 diaries in different formats, some very sort of girly style with little lockets, some more restrained. And there were 38 notebooks, all aligned when we found them. And it's over a period of 55 years. The diaries are interrupted. There are spaces where there are no diaries. The notebooks are just through from the late 30s to her demise in 1995.
So now you have mentioned this a little. Is there a difference that you see in the diaries as she goes through the years?
Yes. In the beginning, well, first of all, in the beginning, as we mentioned before, she writes her diaries in five languages, in English, German, French, Italian, and Spanish. Also, in the beginning, in the diaries, she notes everything from who called, who she had lunch with, whom she slept with, what she read, what she wrote, who said what, what she succeeded in selling, short stories at that time, who offended her, whom she offended. We have a kind of an amount of detail which is just staggering. It comes up to sometimes 700 pages per year. And as it goes along, it becomes less and less, maybe because her life is less full of life. It's less intense. And also, it gets more polished. It gets more a kind of a resume of a day or of several days. In the end, you only just have maybe a dozen pages per year, max.
You know, from some of the first excerpts that Patricia Highsmith makes clear her love of literature. She wrote this in April of 1941. "My appetite is twofold. I hunger for love and for thought. Together, those two can take me anywhere." This really is a young woman who's hungering to know the world around her and about great literature, right?
Absolutely. Great literature and also hunger for thought. She hungered for two things. She hungered, just read, for life. So she put about three lives into one, or three lives into one day. It's absolutely staggering what she can put into a day. So she is also experimenting with life. She doesn't know where she's heading yet, what kind of person she can or will be or wants to become. So she just puts in kind of three different ways of living into one day or into her daily chores. Maybe you want to come to it later, her writing for the comics and the other aspect, as you pointed out, is hunger for thought. She read voraciously in American literature, and then a lot of European literature. Her favorites were Edgar Allan Poe, with whom she shared a birthday, Dostoevsky, and a person whom we will maybe get to, a guy called Karl Menninger.
Let me ask you about that. You know, most of, I think, Americans are familiar with Talented Mr. Ripley, Strangers on a Train, but she wrote 22 novels, numerous short stories. I think one of the favorites that she wrote in terms of novels for me is Tremor of Forgery. Is it fair to say that Patricia Highsmith as an author is better known in Europe than in the United States?
Yes. Well, during her lifetime, let's say, in the 50s and 60s, she had her apex of fame in the United States. In later years, she wrote more literary novels, novels where there is less murder, and she was read in Europe much more as a literary author. And so books like Edith's Diary, where there's no murder, was a huge bestseller in Germany. She was she received accolades by very prominent literary authors here, while in the United States, Edith sold nothing. And she was even in kind of on the short list for the Literary Nobel Prize in 1991. She lost against Nadine Gordimer, but you see her stature.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned this. A lot of people don't realize that in the beginning, she wrote comics, wrote for the comics.
Yes. Right? That's true. Well, it wasn't that she wanted to write for the comics. Mm-hmm. It was just that after college, she couldn't land a job where she wanted most ardently, which would have been at the New Yorker or at Harper's Bazaar or even Vogue. At an interview, she had a job interview at Vogue and appeared without a little hat and with a creased blouse. And so she was turned down, although she, of course, would have had all the facility or all the brains, of course, to do that. And then she answered an ad for the comics, where she, for 7 years, without telling anybody officially, she wrote texts for the comics alongside rather famous people. It's one of her best kept secrets. But she learned a lot. She learned how, in many ways, one can argue that even an early story that she first wrote pre-comics called The Heroine is about an au pair who wants to become a hero. And how does she become a hero? She sets fire on the house of her employers in order to be able to save the children. And if you look at all these superheroes, if you look at Superman, what else does he do? He has a drab life during the day as a boring journalist, and at night he saves the world. So this split and the economy of style begins then.
Now, Patricia Highsmith was born in Texas, but lived in Europe most of the time as an adult. And she had some, pretty strong views about Texas and America. Here's a clip from a 1978 interview that she did with Thames Television in Britain with Mavis Nicholson.
Was there a dislike about America in you?
There was certainly a boredom in Texas. And Texas is, I think, very boring. Hmm. Even the newspapers are mediocre there. And I do like New England, and I like Pennsylvania. It's near enough to get to New York. But all in all, I find Europe more interesting and the people more interesting.
She did have some really strong opinions. This is about places like 1950s era, McCarthy era America, didn't she?
She loved Texas for two things. For her grandma, Willie Mae Coates, with whom she lived for a part of her childhood. And she loved Texas also for her cousin, who was kind of a brother.
When you started editing the diaries and notebooks, you promised that not to avoid, I guess, some of her more troubling traits and thoughts. Patricia Highsmith reportedly described herself to some friends as a Jew hater. And that comes up in past biographies of her. Are there entries that reflect that mindset that you came across in terms of the diaries? There's no question she had prickly personality. She could be tough to deal with for some people.
Oh yes, she could be tough to deal with also with me. She grew up in New York, mm-hmm. As an outsider, as a Texan, with other pupils who were mainly Catholics and Jews from refugees from Europe, and then later as an American in Europe. She as a lesbian in a heterosexual society, so she was always an outsider, and she felt she had a more difficult life than anybody else. She always dreamed of a house in the country with a cool blonde wife and children, and something that she never achieved, of course. So. Particularly when she grew more frustrated because her dreams could not be fulfilled, she started lashing out against kind of everybody and against the outside world that were Catholics, the Pope, the American president, American politics, then the Israel settlers policies, women also, only animals were spared. I think it's important to also have a kind of historical perspective. We are all Neanderthals in relationship to the future. How will future generations judge our current times? Imagine you were born in 1921 in Texas. What would your worldview have looked like when you were 18? There was Henry Ford, an anti-Semitic person, Brundage from the Olympiads, anti-Semitic, Lindbergh, the appeaser, who was an anti-Semitic. It was a very anti-Semitic society, and we are all part of our society. I don't want to defend her, but particularly in the 40s, I think she just reflected her times, and she mostly defended her friends, who were mostly Jewish, and her lovers were Jewish. So she just had the language sometimes, that kind of thing.
Yes, I know that one of her biographers, Richard Bradford, said that she also made no secret of her thoughts about Blacks or Asians. But then again, you take a look at what she says later. This is in April of 1945, and she writes about having a hope for an end to language difficulties and racial pride and prejudice. And in point of fact, she grew up in New York with the Black children with which she got along within her school and in her neighborhood.
Exactly. It was only her grandmother who was shocked that she had Black friends in New York and wanted to implored the mother to make her change schools because of that. But what she disliked about Texas in the 50s. And also 40s, 50s, and 60s was exactly this. She thought that at least in her family, people were too racist, and she couldn't take it, particularly against people of color.
Now, I'm going to switch a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about Tom Ripley. She was in very famous characters, not just because of the movie, but also the book. She was in Positano, Italy, on a trip when she came up with this idea of a character of Tom Ripley, right?
Yes, but we don't read that in the diary. We only learn that very late, much later, in when she writes a little essay in 1990. But that was one of her. She was in a hotel in Positano, looking out to the beach very early in the morning, seeing a lonely figure walking on the beach, and that was the kind of germ of idea. This is how she phrases it. She not only studied English at university, but also zoology. So you see that germ of an idea, like a virus, planted in her. And she later turned this virus or germ into the beginning of a novel.
Now, what she writes about Ripley, she says that no book was easier for her to write. Actually, there are several Ripley books, but she says no book, no character really was easier for her to write. Here's a quote. "I often had the feeling that Ripley was writing it and I was merely typing." Is that the impression you got as well from reading?
Oh, yes. And she also told me how easy this was. Kind of that novel was a gift to her. It just streamed out of her. She had a few novels that just came out of her, and she just had the feeling that she had to type on the typing machine on her typewriter, and Ripley was writing it, or some other person was writing it, and that the words came through the typewriter like nails on the paper.
Tell me, how did the two of you meet? You've said that she could be difficult to deal with, even with you. So how did you, and to be an editor, of course, you have to be someone that the author trusts. So how did the two of you meet?
Well, that was way back in 1984. I had just come back from a year of working for a literary agency in New York, which represented Patricia Highsmith in the U.S. At that time, Patricia Highsmith had no longer a steady American publisher. Mm-hmm. And my publisher in Switzerland came one day and put a manuscript on my desk saying, "This is Found in the Street, a new novel by Patricia Highsmith. I arranged for you to meet her in 2 days. You will meet her at a hotel and you will talk to her about this new novel." I was barely 25, and that was kind of daunting because I knew from the US that she was difficult. And so I went to meet her in a garden, and I stuck out my hand to say hello. She left my hand dangling in the air, ordered a beer, and fell silent. So that was a very great kickstart. But then I started talking about the manuscript, and this is a book set in Greenwich Village. And I said, I loved the novel and I loved the characters, but I had the feeling that it was kind of like in a fairy tale, or like in the 50s. It felt to me like the 50s. And she said, "Yeah, that's no surprise, because I lived in New York in the 50s and I had some kind of life similar to this." And this for me was a huge opening, because this was like getting a glimpse of her youth, of how she was, and then we really started talking, and in the end she even laughed. And then I went back to the publishing house, telling the publisher, you know, at the beginning it was really difficult. She didn't speak much. So she, to my surprise, I thought he would say, well, we change editors. But to my surprise, he said, what? She taught me. It took me years to get either a yes or a no out of her. So begs the question. But
you know, I've heard her described as, I guess, one of the most conflicted and fascinating novelists of the 21st century. Would you agree with that?
She had a prickly outside and a much softer inside, a very vulnerable inside. And when she laughed, when she smiled, it was like the sun coming through a thick cloud. And she was difficult. She was complicated. She was contradictory. She was complex, but a challenge. I found her a challenge, and I've also found her endearing at times.
You know, even with multiple biographies of famous people, we never really know the person, the subject. What we learn is, I guess, the author's impression of the individual about whom they've written. And even though this is not a biography, since these are excerpts that come from her diaries and her notebooks, is it fair to say that this leaves us with a better impression of Patricia Highsmith than anything about her that would be written by someone else?
Yes, I would say so, because you see life as it happens. You are with her while she lives it. It's not in an autobiography or in a biography from hindsight, where you kind of polish everything, you turn the story into a hero story. Here you have the person who shows herself like an operation on an open heart, and you see it. You see her suffering. You see her living to the full. You see her loving. You see her, particularly in the beginning, young and romantic and gushing and bubbling and experimenting with life and love and writing and with all her obsessions and addictions.
You know, I'm curious. Patricia Highsmith has been quoted as saying, "No writer would ever betray his secret life. It would be like standing naked in public." So yes. She had to have written these notebooks, these diaries, with the expectation that someday they'd be made public, didn't she?
It was a long way. The notebooks, we know, she certainly wanted published. She already at a very early time in her life, she wanted one of her college friends, with whom she also has had an intense correspondence, Gloria Kingsley Scatterball, and she also rearranged and corrected and kind of reintegrated earlier notebooks into later notebooks in order to have a complete picture. As far as the diaries are concerned, she battled with herself for a long time. She knew she was dying because she has in the early 90s, and she was considering either burning them or giving them over to the Her Story Society in Brooklyn. And then in the end, she didn't. She turned them over as part with the notebooks as part of her literary work, and also wrote could sort of confirm this in so far as she wrote that in her contract, A, with us, her international publisher, and B, also with the literary archives to whom the her literary remains went.
Her antisocial views aside, Patricia Highsmith's success was due at least in part to her keeping a very disciplined writing schedule. Here's a clip from a 1978 interview with Mavis Nicholson.
If I'm working on a novel, I like to do 8 pages a day. And almost the same with a short story. Sometimes a short story, one can do 10. And I try to take care of the boring things in the morning and work maybe 4 or 5 hours a day.
She had a kind of routine in her day that was really special, particularly in her early days when she tried to squeeze in her comics and writing short stories. She woke up sometimes with a friend, sometimes alone, and she got herself a cup of coffee. She got herself a stale donut and she went into bed in a fetal position in order to daydream as unconsciously as possible, in order to come up with the ideas for her stories. And she had an immense discipline.
You have said that there's a quote that you have about Texas from Patricia Highsmith that you wanted to make sure that people knew about. Can you share that with us?
Of course, particularly since she was ambivalent about Texas, I would like to share something rather boisterous. On the 11th of August in 1950, she writes in her notebook, "Texas, I shall write about it as it has never been written before. The Levi's, the secondhand cars, the oil millionaires, the jukebox songs of women, redheaded, slatternly, in cotton house dresses, who must be loyal and true. My God, what are they doing? Always be mine, that we never will part, the secondhand car, but mostly the clean young dunces, the lean thighs, the blonde girls, the fresh food in the refrigerator, the sense of space just beyond the town's limits, the rodeo next week, and the absolute certainty that the young men's bodies are in perfect condition, the legs spare and hard, and the spirit too clean. The women's voices, southern but not dazingly southern, soft within without being weak. They are clean like the bodies and minds of the young men. The jukebox songs, though whining and sentimental, are only whining because we have not yet developed our poetry. Texas, with the faith of the people who were born there, living there still, the beautiful, quiet, flat homes, the beautiful girls who inspire the men who drive bombers over Germany, Russia, and Korea. Infinite is the word for Texas. Infinite."
That's from 1950.
Yes.
Amazing quote. She is always reminiscing and paying attention to what is around her. That never ceases in her work.
No. She's constantly observing everything. And from she makes detailed notes all the time. In her diary, about her own kind of body, if you like, and in her notebooks about the transformation of her life into stories, about what she observes, into germs of stories. She develops them there in the notebooks and then onto the onto the pages of her manuscripts.
You know, she wrote so much. Did there remain countless short stories and essays and maybe novels that she did that are still unpublished?
There are still short stories that are unpublished. We published just after her demise, we published two volumes of short stories. In the United States, they're published in one volume. By Norton, they were a huge success. It was the first time that Patricia Highsmith, who could never get one of her stories into the New Yorker, had this kind of accolade, the supreme accolade by the New Yorker, because one of her stories was published there after her demise. And there are a lot of essays, a lot of articles, a lot of poems. Some poems we see in the diaries and notebooks. She's a supreme poet. That's one of the discoveries I made in the diaries. It's just, they're so intense and passionate and lovely. Then there are a lot of drawings and paintings. There are unfinished novels, but only parts of them, unfortunately, they haven't survived, other than a satirical novel. On the novel side, we don't really have much to look forward to, but with regard to short stories, essays, and articles, there's still a wealth to come.
You know, should we take every word that she's put in the diaries as truth, or is there a chance that she is writing just a different kind of fiction in her notebooks and in the diaries and giving us a glimpse of yet another Patricia Highsmith character?
She certainly had a darker view of things when she noted them down. She often said that these past days I didn't write a diary because I was too happy. So we have this kind of darker side, probably. So it's not. This is kind of a bias. But I would never say it's fiction. No. We see, for example, one of her lovers later wrote a memoir about the 2 years they spent together. That was Mary Jane Meeker in a lovely memoir. And Highsmith's account in the diaries and notebooks is much darker than Mary Jane Meeker's account. So here you have the comparison. You see the darker kind of shade that goes over the life they led together. But Patricia Highsmith was very honest. Often she portrayed herself in certain situations where she didn't play a very positive role, and she wrote about that too. She didn't glorify herself, so there is little reason to believe that she that these were fantasies.
Are you aware of anybody that has ever provided so much of themselves, an honest view of themselves in terms of their writing, introspection, that sort of thing, as you've gotten from looking at these diaries and the notebooks?
You mean in comparison to other writers?
Yes. Anybody else? I'm not aware of that, but that doesn't mean anything.
Many people have, or some people have compared her to Sylvia Plath or okay. to Simone de Beauvoir.
Simone de Beauvoir,
but,
yeah.
but just also from the wealth of introspection. But I'm not aware that somebody would have gone about this in this double perspective also of keeping of this kind of double bookkeeping about herself, diaries and notebooks in parallel every single day. At the end of each day, you have her writing her diary and her notebook. And to keep that kind of double record or double mirror on her life in that regularity for 55 years, I personally have no comparison.
You know, we live these days in an age of cancel culture where people demand the removal of material or authors whose work they find to be objectionable. Is there any chance of that happening with the release of her most intimate thoughts with this? It'd be a terrible shame, you would think, but is there a chance that that could happen?
I don't know, but I don't think so. From the echoes we've had so far, no. You see, there were some people voicing complaints about Patricia Highsmith's disparaging remarks on Jews or minorities in her late life. And they came out after her death. And they were mainly in the biographies, or it was her erstwhile publisher in the United States from Mysterious Press, or in the epilogue of the memoir I just mentioned by Mary Jane Meeker, who met her again at the very end of Patricia Highsmith's life. The cancel culture is a relatively recent phenomenon. So the announcement of the publication of the diaries and notebooks almost coincided with the cancel culture gaining momentum. And at the same time, we have a huge renaissance of Patricia Highsmith, her books published by Norton, and we have who rebrand her as a literary author. And at the same time, there is a huge interest from movie directors. We have the recent movie by Todd Haynes of Carol with Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. We have Deep Water coming out. We have a TV Ripley series coming out. We will see. From what people talked about her as being anti-Semitic and making racist remarks. This is one chapter, and her diaries and notebooks is another chapter. There is not as much as I thought there would be. Indeed, I was pleasantly surprised that there wasn't so much evidence of that, particularly not in her early years.
You know, at her memorial service, a poem that Patricia Highsmith authored was read. The poem was, "A toast to optimism and to courage, a glass to daring, and a laurel to the one who leaps." That's the kind of poetry that you were saying that you can see, that you saw throughout her work?
Yes, this was one. There is a lot of love poetry. There is a lot of poetry exactly to daring, to leaping. There is poems about doubt, poems about writing, poems about different places, Italy, France, but mostly poems that she wrote about her lovers, or about love in general.
A combination of aplastic anemia and lung cancer took the life of Fort Worth-born Patricia Highsmith in February of 1995. She died in Switzerland, where she had been living. Among her 22 novels are many short stories, The Talented Mr. Ripley, Strangers on a Train, and Carol. Her longtime editor, Anna von Planta, edited the newly released Patricia Highsmith Notebooks and Diaries. Anna, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. Use any podcast app to get the Think podcast, or go to our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm John McKay, in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.